This is Lee Nichols in Austin, Texas. The date is May 4th, 1978, and we have the privilege of having at our Voice of America microphone Okot Batek, Ugandan writer, and to start with and also to get a little of your voice level, Mr. Batek, if you would pronounce your name correctly for me, just say a few words so I can get the voice level.
No, it's Okot Batek. The P is silent, and it simply means kot is rain. That means when I was born, the afterbirth contained bubbles of water, and so I was immediately, naturally called Okot, off the rain, because that's a sign of rain. And Batek means one day he will become strong.
Now, we have all the biographical data all separately, and we'll check out a couple of points if necessary later. One of the things I want to ask you, Mr. Batek, to begin with, is what elements, in your opinion, in your family background, from your father, your mother, your family, your early childhood, may have played an influence in your becoming a writer and the kind of writer you became? I note in one of your own introduction to Horn of My Love, you speak of your mother having been a composer, dancer, one time leader of girls in Palaro chiefdom, and teaching you songs. I'd like to know a little more.
Well, both my parents were fantastic performers. I think from my father I learned a lot of stories and style of telling stories. But from my mother I learned a great deal about poetry, song, and dance, and so on. And she was always very naughty, and teasing me all the time. Whenever she produced a new song, she would call me and say, "Listen to this new one," and I would listen. And the next week, of course, the song would be known throughout the village and danced and performed. And she kept doing this until I one day wrote a song of Lawino, which is her other name too, so I took it to her and said, this is mine also, you listen to it. And she said, "Sing it." I said, "Well, I couldn't sing it, there was no music to it." And she said, "Is it a love song? Is it a funeral song? What is this?" I said, "You shut up and just listen." And I read to her the first version, which was only 30 pages, and she liked it.
Now, how old would you have been then?
I can't remember.
When you were still a child?
No. I was quite big. I was quite big. Had left college. In fact, I was teaching, and so. But that copy, the 30-page thing, got lost, and so I forgot about it. And about 3-4 years afterwards, I was changing house, and I found it. And then reworked it into that book, then later on, of course, I was encouraged to translate it into English.
Now that would have been the first, the Acholi version.
Yeah.
And I read somewhere that you translated a small portion of it into English for a festival or something, and because it was successful, and then you went ahead and did the whole thing?
Oh, yeah. This was a conference in Nairobi, a cultural thing, and I read a little bit of it, and there were publishers who rushed and came to me and said, look, let's have this, and said, what's all this? So I translated the whole thing. Yeah, well, rather mistranslated the whole thing, because I think the Acholi version is the strongest thing. And incidentally, too, the last verse in the Acholi edition couldn't come through in English, so I gave up. So the English version is much shorter than the Acholi version.
Well, you'll probably want to say more about the problem of converting Acholi and other indigenous language. It's into English. I think one of your biographers has said that you're one of the most successful people in Africa in doing this, even if it can't easily be done perfectly. But I would like, if you will, to reach back in your memory and tell me when or how the idea of becoming a writer got into you, and what are some of the first things that you ever wrote, and what happened to them?
Well, I think we're stressing too much on the word writing. Really, I think we should be talking about creating things using words. Because earlier on I had composed a number of songs too, which became quite popular in East Africa. And at the secondary school, I wrote a little opera in English, and that was quite successful too. I remember the governor coming to attend it, and I think he was a great friend of the headmaster. And the whole city was at school. No, it was great fun. But also, I think at one point or another, I heard the headmaster of our school reading Hiawatha, you know, Longfellow's thing, and I began working on some myth, you know, to produce it in that form. That got lost, of course.
You were trying to translate Hiawatha into Acholi?
No. Working on an Acholi myth.
Oh.
Yeah. This is about the fellow who fought his brother because of some spear thing, you know. It's a fantastic story, but that got lost. But it turned out later on in somebody's play. And, well, I've never talked about this before, but, I was very, very surprised. And again, in that thing, in that play called The Exodus, you find it in some collection. The name Lawene is already mentioned, you know. So it's a very mixed up thing.
Mm. Well, now again, and if the biographers are inaccurate in their impression, you will correct it, I'm sure, but there's a suggestion that in your early ideas about writing or creation of things with words, music, you had followed to some extent the English tradition and heritage, but that in your studies at Oxford University, you began to change your ideas, partly because of some derogatory things. In fact, it was you said this yourself in one of your books on religion, derogatory things that one of your professors said about African culture, but also your own awakening interest in the oral tradition, in the traditional culture of the Acholi people. So I'd like to know a little bit about the development of your thinking and your writing.
Well, I don't really think I changed very much. I think right from the beginning I was very proud of the tradition, or the Acholi tradition, because I had danced and taken part in things, and as I was telling you, my mother was always in the background, you know. So going to Oxford was really no development, except that when I was there, I did this study, this thesis on the tradition to get to know it even more. But you know, I went to Oxford by accident. I was doing this law degree in the University of Wales, and we came across this. This is English legal history. And the professor was talking about trials by ordeal, you know, by fire, by water, and so on and so forth. And I told him after the lecture that I would be very interested in studying this a little more, because this is still happening in northern Uganda, where I come from. And so he picked up the phone and rang up Oxford, you know, and he spoke to Professor Evans Pritchard, one of the greatest giants, you know. And he said, I have a very promising student here doing law, but he would like, I think, to look into his own culture a little more. And he said, okay. So as soon as the law degree was finished, I just walked into Oxford, and it was great fun.
Now, how did your studies of oral tradition in northern Uganda work into your writing?
I really don't think this is extremely important. I just wanted to get to know this thing a little more, to understand my people a little more. And I don't see too much influence of this in it, except, of course, that in Song of Lawino, for instance, and in other the other songs, you'll find quotations from Proverbs, like "Let the pumpkin in the old homestead not be uprooted," and you have some actual quotations of songs, you know, and perhaps later on I'll sing you one of them. They're all there, but I think I had learnt all this before, and I was just going to do an anthropological study of the social institutions, but using the studies of the poets in the area, of the storytellers in the area, you know. And this has, of course, led me also to the study of religion and things, using the oral tradition. Because I think when people came to Africa and began to ask very loaded questions, they didn't get the answer that they wanted. And I was thinking that perhaps a more reasonable way of knowing a people is to shut up and listen to their thinkers, you know, listen to the stories they're telling, listen to the songs they're singing, and then interpret this. I think we get a deeper meaning of the social institution of a people that way.
Then, do you see yourself as much of an interpreter of your people and their songs and their poetry and their philosophy as, shall I say, an innovator of new things apart from them?
I think both. I like to understand this thing very, very closely, because I think our political systems should include the thought of our people too. The economic institutions should include the thoughts of the people. In fact, everything. I think a successful missionary has to understand the people, otherwise they're going to talk at cross purposes all the time anyway. And they have been. Let me give you a little example. In 1911, some Italian priest turned up in northern Uganda and began asking elders questions which they couldn't understand. Said, "Who created you?" Well, this is a Christian conception, isn't it? But in my culture, you have all sorts of verbs for all sorts of creations. You know, you create a pot, you create a house, you create a song, a woman creates a child, you know, this kind of thing. Anyway, this question could not be answered. So the interpreter said, nothing doing. So he said again, who molded you? You know, again, thinking of the Genesis story, I think. And these elders began to walk away because they thought the man was nuts in the head. He's not making sense. But somebody among the crowd said, no, I think he means that if a child is properly born and he's molded, then he becomes a hunchback, you know. Now, in that tradition, every disease has a spiritual counterpart. No. So when you're dealing with somebody who is sick, you deal not only with the physical thing, but also with the spiritual thing. So the spirit which is responsible for the tuberculosis of the spine is called Lubanga. No. So he said, I think he's asking for Lubanga. Yeah, so he wrote it down, this foolish man. And on Sunday, you know, he rang the bell. And people came, and he stood on top of the anthill and started preaching. And he was saying that he has brought great news, you know, the most wonderful news of a God who loves you very much. And this God is called Lubanga. Can you?
And that's where the idea of God, the hunchback, came.
The hunchback. That's the idea of the hunchback in Song of Lawino. But you're not talking to the people unless you hear them. But at the same time, I think one is a critic, looking at the new system in Africa today, the new chaos, which is coming on, based, I think, also on the fact that we have not understood our people properly, based on the fact, too, that the military has not understood its role, that the military, in fact, is just serving some master, you know, not protecting the people. And the and so on and so forth. So one is a critic asking, where are we going? What is the kind of society we're building? You know.
Well, I want to get into that in a few moments in another way, but I would like you to say a few words about what you consider to be some of your most important works in the writing field, or songs, or whatever you want to do with words. But you. In sequence of time, which is not too important, but still, as I read it, one of your first works was a novel in Acholi.
Yes. This was a criticism of the bride wealth system, because by that time, you know, that came out in 1953, you know, perhaps some of the earliest writings, the bride wealth, which used to be a form of a gift, you know, by the man's people to the woman's people, had become slightly commercialized. And it's a story of this young man whose father is dead and cannot get any money to sort of buy the woman, really. So he goes to town, but he also studies the city very well, you know. And then somehow gets some little job, and on his way back home, the money is stolen, and the most terrible scene there is the last chapter, when the young man goes home, you know, having arrived by bus, you know, he walks to his home about 20 miles or so, and he cannot dare to go there by day because he's so ashamed, you know. He knows what mother is hoping for and so on. So he walks very slowly and reaches there by night, you know, and he gets to the back of the house and hears the mother crying, you know. She'd been beaten by some other man, and she's saying, wait until my son comes back and he'll get married, you know. And then some other boys, having seen him, thinks that he's coming to steal a woman, you know. We're not expecting, so they get hold of him and beat him up and then recognize him, you know. And the story ends there. It's a bitter story.
That's never been translated into English.
I can't. I've tried three versions. Perhaps one day, but I'm never happy with the translation at all, because there's a lot of... you know this thing called praise name? There's a lot of exchange of that, and those are just impossible to get across into English. And perhaps one day. There are three versions now which I've tried.
Well, now of course, Song of Lawino was the first major one of your works. Which, well, let me go back and ask, what happened to the novel in Acholi? Is the full name Laktar, or is there
Laktar? Laktar is White Teeth.
Sorry, say it again.
White Teeth. But behind it, this is my father's praise name, and he says when people laugh, it's not necessarily because they're happy, but because they're trying to show that they have white teeth, you know. Laktar, White Teeth.
What happened to the book?
It's published. It's in fact, it's right there. And
did it get any recognition or anything?
Well, in Acholi land, it's so popular, you know, and I think it has been copied too, you know, in style, by two or three other authors who wrote in that medium, but since it was not translated, you know, we don't hear of it too much from outside.
Well, I think that you've already told me the genesis of Song of Lawino, how you wrote it as a small piece of poetry or song for your mother. But the ideas in Song of Lawino, I think, emphasize the idea of the validity of the old cultural values, the tribal, the traditional, the village values, as against certainly an imposition of new Western values without any thought whatsoever. I wonder if you'd say a little bit about what was in your mind when you wrote Song of Luino, what you wanted to say in it and what you do say in it.
Well, I think this is a total review of modern Africa in terms of the way in which the village woman looks at it, you know. And she's asking all the questions, you know, all the questions dealing with this copying thing, you know. She says we cannot just go on being apes, we must be ourselves. If you copy other people all the time, your creativity, you know, diminishes. And then she looks at the whole thing, of course, the dance tradition, for instance, the religious thing, and she's so skeptical about the whole thing, you know, the Christian thing, the way in which the priests are really sometimes hypocritical. She looks at the political system and how the political leaders are not looking after the population, but only at their stomachs, you know. And one of the most interesting things in Luino is her view of creation, because and my daughter likes this very much too. We always discuss it. The size of things, you know, because my mother also used to make pots, you know, and clay. And things. So when you're talking about creation, then she's thinking in terms of getting some clay, you know, from some place, and then kneading the thing, letting it sleep overnight, and then making the thing. So in this version about creation, she asks, where is this great river from which God got the clay, you know, the clay for making earth, the whole thing, the clay for making sun, the clay for making all the stars, you know. So you can see the size is just fantastic. Because she also questions how God created himself, you know, using whose hand and things, you know. But I think there is also a look at the medical situation, concept of health, you know, and so on. The book just looks at the whole thing. And I think it's hopeful at the end because she thinks it is possible for the African man to redeem himself, to become creative in his own place, to call himself an African. This is my home, you know, and I'm the master here, you know, and this is my culture, and so on.
Well, now, what tempted you to write the Song of Ochol following the Song of Luino, Ochol being the husband that Luino, the wife, was criticizing for his Western ways? And do you feel that Ochol really gave a good account of himself in his book?
No, but of course not. He couldn't. And in some ways, it was meant to make Ochol even more stupid. You know, he never answers anything. But in some parts also, he begins to question himself, you remember? He's asking the historian, you know, what is it? What is it? He also asks the question, you know, what kind of society are we building? You know, towards the end of the book, I think Ochol is, you know, not too sure of the kind of stance he takes. He's very destructive. He wants to destroy mountains, you know, all the forests, you know, the whole thing, and the rivers must start flowing the wrong way, you know. But as I say, towards the end, he's not too sure.
Well, did you write that primarily to show him? In other words, what was the motivation for writing the Song of Ochol?
Well, I suppose we are all Ocholes. All of us have gone to school, and we want to question our stance. Also, I think. Do you know when you take a pen and start writing, you don't ask that question. You don't even know what the motivation is. So this is just a kind of rationalization, really. I never knew what was happening. But towards the beginning, I think it was to make Laweno's arguments even stronger. And of course, as I say, at the end, he's very doubtful himself. Okay, very different from Laweno's hopeful thing, you know, at the end of the of Song of Laweno.
Okay, well now, after the Song of Ochol, one of the biographies I read said something about a book called Revelation of a Prostitute. Is that correct?
Well, Song of Prostitute. This is again a look at society by a prostitute, you know, and looking and laughing at all our hypocrisies.
Excuse me, but is that the same thing as Song of Malaya?
Yeah.
Okay.
Song of Malaya is Malaya is Swahili for prostitute.
Okay.
And so she again is looking at the whole thing and laughing at us all. You know, we condemn them and then imprison them, but support them. You know, and in any case, I sometimes really think these are great characters. They serve society in their own way, and so on.
Would you care to say a little bit about the book Two Songs, the genesis of each of the songs in that, and when it was written, and so on?
Well, Song of Malaya is the one we've just been talking about, but Song of Prisoner has a very strange background. First of all, one day I was traveling from Nairobi to Kisumu, a small town, and I was very tired, and I think I caused a lot of trouble or something. So I was taken out of the train, you know, and put in a cell, you know. The next day, of course, I got out by getting the biggest man around, you know, the governor of the place, you know, he put on his uniform, and he got me out. I lost one shoe. So I went home. But the next weekend, a prominent Kenyan politician was killed, Tom Mboya. Yeah. And he was a great friend of mine. We didn't agree on lots of things. His politics, his terribly pro-Western approach to things, his tremendous belief in very highly capitalistic style of life, that we didn't agree with. But whenever he came to Kisumu, he would sit down, he would call me, say, Mwalimu, teacher, come, let's have a drink and continue the debate. So, and that was a Saturday afternoon, and we were watching a soccer match, you know, and the news was announced at the stadium, the game broke up. I went into my office and started writing Song of Prisoner. So the openings of Song of Prisoner is my own experience, really. You know, you sleep on that stone floor, you know, and the light is there. They never put it out. But it was as it were me arresting the killer of this famous man and putting him in my office and getting him to talk. So this is the other character looking at present day Africa.
And this was written when you were connected in Kisumu. You were connected with the University of Nairobi as a resident tutor.
That's right. And it was written in a very festive situation too, because I was organizing this Kisumu Arts Festival, and a lot of fun, but a very angry book, as you can see there.
Well, was the Song of Prisoner written before Song of Malaya?
Yeah, it was. Song of Malaya was written also in Kisumu when the Kenya Parliament passed a law against vagrants, they call them, you know. But of course, they really meant prostitutes and things. They wanted to get rid of them and so on. So one night we were drinking in this little place, and the soldiers broke in, you know, and arrested all the women, you know, including people's wives, you know. And of course, they came back the next day. But then I went on the other side of the city, and we were still drinking. Then the soldiers broke in there again, and this time you had upstairs, there are rooms where people have little fun, and they went knocking on those doors and arresting all the women, but not the men. So I was so angry by this kind of thing. That's how Song of Malaya came to be written.
And the two songs, Song of Prisoner and Song of Malaya, won the I'm trying to remember whether it's Mzee Kenyatta or Jomo Kenyatta Prize for Literature in English in East Africa for 1972. You told me earlier you were surprised that it got that award.
Well, knowing the subject of the poem, I was slightly surprised.
How did you find out about it, that you got the award?
Oh, it was announced all over the place, and the publishers, of course, you know, put a lot of advertisements about it, and wrote on the book too. This is the prize winner and so on. And I got some money out of it too. They gave me some little money to celebrate with.
You want to talk about any of your other books at the moment?
Well, I told you earlier, I very much disagreed with the way in which African religions were being discussed by Western scholars and African scholars. And so I wrote that book called African Religions in Western Scholarship, in which I surveyed the whole thing and tried to point out, no, that things are not really going well. And then I had to do my own thing, of course, to show the kind of thing I would like to see being done. So I wrote Religion of the Central Luo, and I think they've been quite successful. They're being studied all over the place. I've had invitations from lots of places to go and talk about this kind of approach I'm trying to preach. But recently I embarked on a major study of traditional literature, and so I've published the poems Horn of My Love, again covering, you know, from children's plays to love song to religious things to battle songs, you know, to you know, the whole thing. And then only yesterday I got the proof for my stories, you know, Heinemann are putting it out.
What stories?
Oh, these are fantastic stories. Do you want to hear one?
Sure.
let me tell you the naughty one about Hare and his mother-in-law, you know. Now Hare was married to this fabulous woman. She's beautiful, you know. And they were really in love, and they had kids too, nice little things. And it was wonderful kind of marriage, and everybody was saying, hey, look at this. But one day, you know, the mother-in-law turned up, and that one was beautiful. The mother-in-law was something else, you know. Now, first of all, she refused to grow old, you know, and same size, height, like the daughter, same build. But when they were walking away from you, it was difficult to tell who was who, you know. But the waist of the mother-in-law was slightly softer than that of the daughter. So Hare was in little trouble because, of course, it's not allowed. But the temptation was not small, you know. Oh, And in any case, you know, these things which are not allowed are very sweet. So, anyway, Hare began to study the movement of the mother-in-law. And he discovered, first of all, that mother-in-law is very fond of basking in the sun. You know, every morning when the sun is about 10 o'clock, she would come out and sit down and bask until lunchtime, and then she would go back and have supper, we call it supper lunch or something. Then, that was the first discovery. Very important. Mother-in-law, fond of basking in the sun. Okay. Now, the second discovery, which is even more critical, was that mother-in-law always wants to sit in the same spot, you know? And he watched this very carefully and discovered, secondly, that mother-in-law always sits in exactly the same spot. So, one day, Hare marked this same spot with a small leaf. And very early in the morning, about 5, he came out of the house and scooped the sand out and put himself inside, you know, and somehow covered himself again so that you couldn't tell, you know, that there was anybody underneath. So, 10 o'clock, mother-in-law saunters out, sits in exactly the same spot. So, but that night, that day, the sun was much sweeter than usual because mother-in-law was not sitting still. She was moving a little bit, you know, moving a little bit, sometimes up and down, sometimes sideways, you know, sweating a little. I think the sun that day was very sweet. And when it was lunchtime, the daughter called, "Mother, food is ready." And she said, "Ah, I'm already satisfied." So she refused to eat. But later on, anyway, in the evening, when people were sitting around the fire, there was a piece of gourd, which had seen them. So it started making noise and singing, "Pengle, pengle, pengle, hey. Pengle, 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 a boy of Marane, pengle, or Timonica de morning, pengle, nook, 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 nook." Pengle, pengle is the falling of this piece of wood. And say, "Hey, Hare and his mother in law did a certain something very sweet." The thing goes, "Nook, nook, 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 nook." It was only Hare who had this thing. So he took the piece of wood and went to the end of the swept compound and hurled it away. But it flew back, it was louder. "Pengle, pengle!" Hare seized it, went into the kitchen, got a mortar, and crushed the thing into powder, you know, and put some water in it and drank it. Then he came and sat around the fire, and people said, "Oh, Hare, what is it?" He said, "Oh, I was thirsty, that's all." "So what about all this noise?" Hare said, well, "I think something fell." So, anyway, in a short moment, his stomach went, which meant he had to go to, we call it the bathroom here. But of course, in Africa, you go into the grass far, far, far away. So he squatted there and, oh, the thing came out again. And it flew back, and it was louder. "Pengle, pengle, pengle, yo, pengle, 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 yo." So Hare was, you know, dressing up. Well, when he ran and came back, this thing had told the whole world, you know, that Hare and his mother did a certain something very sweet. Out of this has come a proverb, you know, which says, even if you take your mother-in-law underneath the water, the bubbles will tell.
Now that's one of several stories that you've collected.
Oh, yeah, and I've translated into English and numerous. And I've never laughed when writing, you know, then I was doing these stories. And I think one of the great things is I know them very well. And my father was very instrumental in this. He was just a fantastic storyteller, you know. And but translating this was much easier than translating the other songs in the Horn of My Love. But the next thing, which I've just finished now, are the proverbs, the collection of proverbs, which are, again, are going to be done by Hahnemann. they're a bit difficult to handle, very difficult to handle, because here I think you have some of the deepest thoughts of our people contained in their own vocabulary, which summarizes all sorts of things. And so my approach to the study of Proverbs is slightly very different from the others I've seen, which is this: I state the proverb in English, no, in my mother tongue first, then a little translation in English, and then a detailed, very detailed explanation of what the thing might mean. Mm. I've also run into a lot of problem with classification. At first, I started off by saying, okay, suppose I took the social institutions, marriage and politics and so on. Then I found that some of the proverbs just run right across. There's one which sounds very political, which is that the cockerel from one village does not crow in another one, which is a political thing. I mean, it sounds political, political leaders in one area don't just walk across and start shouting. But I heard this used against a young wife, because the old woman is the cockerel there, so you don't just crow when you just arrived. So I almost gave up this kind of classification. But looking around, there was no other way, so I've kept the classification. But you have cross references, and said it applies here and it applies there. What is most exciting study? You have to know the people very well before you begin to look at the proverbs, but also at the stories and all the songs, the traditional songs, because, as I was saying much earlier on, these are the wisest people who are presenting their culture.
Now, it's obvious from your own writing and your own experience and studies, and also from the preface to your book, that you feel that writing of that using material from the oral tradition, from the culture of the people in Africa, is and vernacular writing, actually written material in the vernacular, is an important element in African literature. Is that correct?
Well, it is basic. I think there's no way in which you can begin to be creative without.
I wanted to quote the line from the preface to your book, Horn of My Love, in which you spoke of what you call the class-ridden dictionary meaning of the term literature, which restricts literary activity and enjoyment to the so-called literate peoples and turns a deaf ear to the songs and stories of the vast majority of our people in the countryside, so that what is known to the people in terms of their singing, their songs, their stories, and when it's written, what's been written in African languages, is, in your opinion, a major part of African literature.
It is the most important part. The songs such as the ones I've published, and the stories such as Achebe and Ngugi have published, it's a small thing in a big sea of very rich material which we need to mine. I think it's extremely important. And I also think that if Africa is going to make a contribution to world literature, we have to have roots. You have to be rooted someplace. You don't just hang in the air.
It's encouraging to me that the African Literature Association, which has its headquarters here in this country, particularly through the impetus of Professor Daniel Kunene,
had a tremendous insistence, a demand that it pay a great deal more attention to African literature written in African languages. Are the songs which you have written in English, the first one having been written first in Acholi, is this, particularly the written form, is this a new development in, shall we say, African writing? I gather that it's something that hasn't been done in that fashion before, but that it has been more or less followed or imitated since.
I think it's something quite new. As I told you, my mother asked me to sing it, and I couldn't. And these are long, long, long songs, you know, dealing with different aspects. The tradition I grew up in had love songs, funeral songs, and so on and so forth, to be danced, to celebrate a particular important occasion, birth and circumcision, and so on and so forth. But no, this is a new thing altogether.
Do you have any particular reason why you call them songs if they're not to be sung primarily?
Well, the word poem doesn't exist in my language, so I call them song. Where is song? Yeah.
I suppose that you're aware, Okad Patek, that, in fact, I think I told you this myself once, that I know specifically of African writers, a young playwright in Liberia by the name of Kona Kaisu, who acknowledged his inspiration for one of his plays from Song of Luino, from this complaint of the women. Have you had any evidences of people taking a sort of a lead from some of the things you've done to create other things, but some of them which may be good, and you know, following your example?
Well, in East Africa itself, there are quite a number of long poems like this coming up. I know quite a number of six or seven young writers who are using this kind of style, very healthy, I think. They've been accused of coping, but I don't think they're coping. I think they're doing their own little thing, you know. But Lawina itself, the Song of Lawina, has been performed on the stage numerous times in Nairobi. One very, very funny attempt was made by a German professor. You know, he came, he's a musician, and he took Song of Lawina and worked on it, you know. And he plays the harpsichord or something, do you know that thing? And it sounded, and they got this woman who was all dressed up, you know, like a ballet dancer or something. And she was performing Lawina, you know, like a great actress in Britain or something. I laughed. But anyway, a great attempt. But very recently, there was a more successful thing done by a woman from some West African place. I'll remember later. And she did it. It was performed at the French Cultural Center. And you know who came? The ambassador was there, stiffly dressed.
The Ugandan ambassador?
No, the French ambassador. And his wife in gloves, you know. It was so funny a setting. But that was a much better performance. Of course, I think they also messed about with it. They did this book scene, you know, my husband's house is a dark forest of book, but they cut out that last bit, you know, and their testicles were smashed with large books. They cut that out. I walked out. You know, there was a reception afterwards. Oh, well, they seized me on the road and brought me back. So what is this? How can you leave out the sweetest part of of a book?
Mr. Patek, I want to ask you now, you've spoken of some of the themes of some of your work. Do you have any sort of anything that could be called an overall goal in your writing, an overall message, an overall purpose as a writer?
Well, I I've not stopped to think about that. But I think in the background, I think one is challenging ourselves, you know, to ask basic questions about the ideal society, about the value of human life, about how we should organize ourselves, you know, about how we should be ourselves and not, you know, try to be anything else, and so on. But I really hold it very strongly that an artist should tease people, should prick, you know, needles into everybody, you know, so that they don't go to sleep and think everything is fine. And I think this is perhaps what one is doing, and suffering for it sometimes, but having a lot of fun.
Well, that is very, very close to the idea in the next question, but if you see any divergence in the question, you can answer it separately or just leave it. And that is, do you feel that in Africa, the writer has a particular role to fulfill in his society?
Not only the writer, the I'll tell about the blind man in northern Uganda who plays an eight-stringed instrument, you know, who is being hunted now by Amin, you know, because he composes the most terrific criticisms of this regime. He was very critical of Obote's regime, you know, and he composed songs and insults, you know. So I'm saying that he's not just the writer, but anybody who is creative, who is sensitive, who is gifted, you know, has a major role in all this thing which is going on. This creativity, of course, is not limited only to writers and these other people in the village, but it's all scholars, the fellows doing sociology, for instance, you know, it's no use just repeating what other people have written in America and Europe and so on, but look at the society critically, the professors of economics, you know, philosophers, so-called, you know, and they keep heaping what Plato said and what all the other thugs said in the past, you know. But we should all be looking at our own society today and asking questions all the time and creating ideas, creating new ideas for the governance of our people.
Well, as a creator of a new trend in African literature yourself, what do you see as the major new trends in African literature today, either in East Africa or all of Africa?
I think perhaps the theater is gaining tremendous ground. And of course, the writers who are creating these things are really going back to the village, you know. And for instance, in Uganda, recently, we've lost a number of playwrights and directors who were killed because they were really portraying the regime and criticizing it, but not using words, you know. They would just go there and dance, sing a few funeral songs, you know. And people come from miles and miles, you know, to come and see. This is taking place in Kenya too. Of course, you heard of the Ngugi story, how he took his play to the village, you know, and people came for a month, you know, from all over the place, because the play was looking at the Kenyan society and saying, look, there was some battle to gain independence, to gain land, you know, and the people who actually fought didn't get anything. In fact, the people who collaborated with the British are the ones who are having everything. And it was a marvelous thing because everybody was taking part in it. If some widow felt provoked, you know, she just walk onto the stage and shut everybody up and tell her story, you know. I lost my husband in that war, and who am I? How do I look now? You know, and don't you think we know the people who killed my husband? Isn't their house quite near here? You know, this kind of thing. I think the theater is moving very, very, very much so in Africa today. Of course, West Africa, you know this story much better.
Okay, two more questions for this particular time. I want to ask you a little bit about the problems of the writer as you see them, both in your society, whichever you want to call your society today, as against yesterday when the writer, at least in all of Africa and East Africa, had very little chance of getting started, getting known, and getting recognized. What are the chief problems of the writer today as you see them?
Well, I think the chief problem for the writer, for any creator in Africa today, is the insecurity of the political leaders who are so sensitive to criticism, mainly because they don't have support. And so they think, you know, if people speak too much, you know, the things might not go too well. Of course, the people know all this, you know, and it takes some writer, some creative person to put it in words, you know. I think that's the chief problem. So we have a lot of writers who are refugees all over the place, you know, crossing borders, one going the other one, and so on, so in jail and so on. But I think this recently has been the main problem. As far as being recognized and so on and so forth, I think this is no longer a problem because I think the world has realized that there's a lot of creativity in Africa. So whenever a new book is published, you know, they go. Sometimes it takes years, of course, to get there, but they do get there. Universities all over the place, you know, are teaching, or I think misteaching African literature. But we have all these kind of visits, such as the one I'm having now. And the African writers are going all over the place. Last year I was in Denmark, and in this country I've been moving all over the place, you know. And so I think that's really is no longer the problem. Publishing used to be a problem, but not now. Well, publishers are flocked into Africa from all over the place. In East Africa, of course, we are very lucky too, because we have indigenous publishing companies which do their best to also publish books in the vernaculars, you know, and this is extremely exciting. Translations are going on all over the place. Just got a letter from Denmark. Ochol and Prisoner have just been translated into Danish. And I was in Moscow the other day. Do you know Lawina has been translated into Kazakh? So we went to Kazakhstan for poetry reading, you know. And I was reading in Acholi, and somebody was reading in Kazakh, and somebody was reading in English, and they all sounded so strange. And of course, it's been written, published in Russian too. So has Prisoner. Prisoner has been sold, so all over the place.
Except that a writer can't in Africa can't make a living by writing alone yet, can he?
No. You can't. You have to do something else. But this is also in the tradition, because the traditional creative person was also a normal farmer, you know, doing other things, you know, but also creating things.
Well, how do you see the future for writing in your part of Africa?
I think the future is quite bright. There are lots of subjects coming up. I'm working on my Song of Soldier. Oh, that's going to be. I don't know how to handle that. But it's a very slow one. It's coming very slowly because I think the wounds in Uganda are still too fresh. But there's plenty of publishing coming on in East Africa, and I think all over the place. Some people have said perhaps that East Africa is taking over the lead from West Africa, and mainly I think also because we are basing most of our works on the traditional setting, getting things from the roots.
Okay, thank you.